Hello and welcome to our next edition of the Work Healthy podcast. I'm John Ryan. Today's guest is world-renowned organizational psychologist Dr. Arnold Bakker, who, along with Evangelia Demaruti, developed the Job Demands and Resource Model, or JDR for short, which has been used extensively by organizations who are passionate about employee well-being and passionate about trying to reduce burnout amongst their workforce. I started our conversation by asking Arnold whether work and workplaces are getting better since he first launched the model in the early 2000s.
That's a very good question. And it's tempting to say that they are better. And there are, of course, a lot of examples where things are going better than they used to be. But I'm working, actually, over the summer, I've been thinking about the history of job design, and I've been working on a new presentation, and I delved into the literature. And you can go back all the way to the 1920s, so 100 years ago, when Taylor was active in the Ford factories with scientific management. So they were up to the most efficient way of producing cars. And now we have Tesla, the new Ford, let's say. And I think that one of the things Elon Musk said the other day is if you want to work at home, if you want to work at Tesla, you have to come to the office. And if you want to work at home, you can do that in the evening. So in terms of thinking about work and thinking about the participation of employees in the decision process, or talking about where do you feel engaged and how can I make you feel engaged while you are working on that I as an employer find important, I think that has not necessarily changed a lot among the, let's say, the billionaires and the very rich people who have a lot to say about workplaces. But on the other hand, we have seen that before the war and in the 60s particularly, there has come a lot of attention for motivation. How can you satisfy people's needs in the workplace? How can you offer job resources? So with our theory of job demands resources, we are building on the shoulders of giants, you could say, in terms of research, in terms of models, and that has been and is applied in a lot of workplaces. But again, I think it's only a fraction of what could be done. So it could be much better because if you really are critical, and I've been in at very big companies, and they don't know too much about job design and about worker well-being. They are interested in money, in investments, in tomorrow's stock market. And I wish that these economists and financially oriented people would know more about worker well-being, about what you can do to keep people happy and engaged in their work, because that will bring them eventually more money and that will attract people more to stay in the organization.
So that's one of the questions. I suppose, you know, these are smart people, you would suggest, by the fact that they've got into these leadership roles. They've obviously got a capacity for spotting opportunities and understanding how business works and the like. But yet they seem to, there's this disconnect between their understanding of the resources that they have in human resources and how they utilize those. And they a lot of them still have this conceptual idea that it's about squeezing the resource for all it's worth, and then if it's wasted, just replace it. I mean, that's still the case with a lot of these people. So why hasn't this light gone on? And why haven't they realized?
I really don't know. So of course there is still in many organizations that and even in our governments, there is a culture of really working like crazy, working hard, making very long weeks. And in some jobs, it seems like there is no other way. Like if you are a minister or you are a president, you have to work like 60, 80 or 100 hours a week. But I think there are other examples in Scandinavian countries where things are a little bit more normal for the people involved. And also, we know from a lot of research that if you rest well after working hard, then the next day you will be better prepared to work again very hard, but not only hard, but also smart and creative and so forth.
And so, you're a runner yourself. So, I mean, like, you know all about recovery and the importance of recovery and the whole process of being brilliant at what you do. So it's interesting that that piece for a lot of those leaders hasn't actually got cut through. But so listen, that we are where we are. Our job, I suppose, is to try and move the dial and bring this to a broader audience so that they start to realize the connections between the two. I mean, one of the things I'd like to sort of say straight off is thank you for your work in bringing the model to the world, because I think it's really important that it's a structured way of thinking about what we have in place. But what I'd love, if it's possible, is for you to kind of go back to the very, very start and what your view of what you were bringing to the world was then, and then compare and contrast that with where you stand today. In the world today, with everything we've been through, has your view of the model changed? Has there been an evolution as part of that process? And if so, what has that been? I know that's a big question. So,
yeah, but there is a big evolution. And if it wouldn't have been there, I think I would have quit my work. So because if you have the same model over and over again, it would be extremely boring. And also, I believe that science is never finished. So if you think that your model is finished, then you're done. Then you should move on, I think. So I think what we did in the beginning, and it was around in the literature, there was actually a meta-analysis by Lee and Ashford in 96 about job demands and resources. But they didn't really speak about it so much in that way. And what Eva Demeruti and me added to the literature together with others is that we said, well, it's very important to make the distinction between demanding aspects of work and resourceful aspects of work, because of the fact that these properties of the workplace or these job characteristics have unique effects. So the unique pathways of job demands instigating the process of putting in a lot of effort and then taking a toll on your health and making people fatigued, that's basically another process than the motivational process, starting with resources that can feed people's intrinsic motivation to continue with the work, makes them happy about what they accomplish and so forth. So the two unique paths, and then later the interactions between job demands and resources, that was the beginning of the model. So acknowledging first that there are these two big broad categories. Then second, a very important thing, and that's one of the reasons why JDR theory is so popular, it's a very flexible model, because we say there is not a fixed set of job characteristics that is important, but it can be different specific demands and resources in the different workplaces. So that makes it very applicable, like in social psychology, you have the theory of planned behavior, and in organizational psychology, we have job demands resources theory. All the previous models, they were having a fixed set of factors, and we say it depends. And that's a big thing. That is the classic way of, and a new way of looking at the workplace, which we started in around 2000. So the big paper that we published was in 2001, but we started in 98, 99 working on this. Things have changed over time since 2003, we started working on daily fluctuations in worker well-being, in job demands and resources. And also we started to look at employee behaviors. So around 2010, we started a lot of work on job crafting, that people play an important role themselves. So whereas the previous models and also the original JDR model was more like a stimulus response, like behaviorism, later on we acknowledged, and nowadays we acknowledge, that people can be really proactive, they can change things themselves in an active way. Through job crafting, through playful work design, by using their strengths and in many other ways, by using their voice, expressing their voice and so forth. And so that is a major difference with between JDR model at the beginning and JDR theory where it is now. And also we just finished a new paper for the annual review of organizational psychology, in which we outline the new developments in the theory. And one of the new ideas is that, about which we have published a few papers also, is that you have these daily processes, for example, job resources, fueling engagement, and then proactive work behavior through which you generate new resources and so forth. So that's a kind of game cycle. On the other hand, we have job demands leading to exhaustion, then self-undermining through which you generate more demands and so forth. So that's a loss cycle. But now we have these fluctuating parts of the model. But we think that on top of that, so this is a daily process, but on top of that, you can think of personality or chronic well-being as a moderator of these processes. So for example, if you are an extroverted person, you will be better able from day to day to mobilize your social resources. Or if you're really burned out and you feel chronically fatigued, then everything in terms of the daily job demands will be more complicated to deal with. So we'll generate more problems on a daily basis. So this multi-level thinking is, I think, also quite new. You don't see that in the previous job design models. And this is much more tailorized. So the implication of that would be that job design efforts, they shouldn't be the same for everyone in the same organization. It should be different for different people. Yeah.
I have it written down here, that whole idea of personality and the impact that personality actually has on this. And one of the things, I think where the workplace is becoming a more difficult place to operate for particularly managers is maybe the requirements for them to deeply understand their people. Mm-hmm. And probably one of the things from going into workplaces for the last 20 years that I see is a massive mismatch. I don't know if you found this, but I feel there's so many people who are just in a wrong job. And it was interesting. I was listening to some of your interviews beforehand where you were talking about, like, you started off in stats and maths, and that was where your skills were. You could have ended up in jobs that were stats and maths orientated. And while you're good at them, they wouldn't have fulfilled you the way that people and that piece. I just feel there's loads of people who slip into just the first thing they seem to be good at.
Yeah.
And there isn't this sort of an assessment process, which is really good at figuring out long term what's going to make you self-fulfilled. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a huge mismatch in organizations and leads to conflict.
Yeah.
So because one of the things in your model, and correct me if I'm wrong, because in looking at that evolution, it was like starting kind of looking at the burnout stuff, but then sort of saying, actually, this can be really positive. And that then there's personal resources that people, it's not only the organizational, it's the personal resources that people are bringing that also, and that, I suppose that links into the personality piece too. So could you talk into the personal resources that people are bringing too, and the impact and how they mitigate? Because I think that's a big word in the work here.
Yeah, well, when it comes to personal resources, these are theoretically lower order personality traits that are malleable. So whereas the big five factors of openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, and so forth are thought to be more stable, although there are, of course, also theories about change in personality. But when it comes to the lower order factors like beliefs about your optimism, self-efficacy, self-esteem, hope, resilience, and so forth, these are malleable. And we know that from research on training, where people are trained to be more optimistic, or people are trained to be more self-efficacious. That's one of the most successful concepts in psychology, I think, the work of Bandura. Yeah. And so we know, and that's why we focused on this particularly, that personal resources can be changed can change over time, can change through training, can change through experiences you have in the workplace. And we also know from our research and research of others that if people have success experiences in the workplace and are exposed to many job resources, then that also generates the feeling of optimism and self-efficacy and so forth, which you then bring with you the next time you meet a demanding customer or have to deal with a lot of workload. So these beliefs about how much impact you can have on the situation will help you very much in how you approach the situation. You will think, okay, let's do this. And you use all the skills that you have to empathetically understand the customer, put in time and effort because you think it will be okay in the long run. And if you don't have that, if you think, oh, this is hopeless, or today is going to be a disaster because I can't do this, then your conversation with this demanding customer will be a completely different conversation. So I think it's very important what people bring in. And so it's not only the workplace, also the personal resource, which can change from day to day, week to week, month to month, and may also change as a function of things that happen in our private life. For example, if there is a major life event like a divorce, then maybe you feel less optimistic and you will be less able to really focus on your work or to bring in optimistic beliefs that you can handle everything. This may, of course, have an impact on how you work. And this is, I think, how often managers and company doctors perceive that the person is the problem. They see the people with the divorce or with a major life event, and they think, oh, you have stress because there's something going on in your private life. But for me, the reality is that in everybody's private life, there's something going on. So we better take it for granted. We know this is life. So things happen and people bring this also to work. So if you're a good organization, you take care of your people. And when they are going through a rough time, then maybe you need to offer them, particularly at that point, more job resources, a little bit lower demands perhaps, so that they can move on to another period where things are going are a bit more normal, let's say.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, like, I think the education system, I'm not sure what it's like in Holland and the Netherlands, but, you know, that idea that I know where I come from in Ireland, we'd never teach self-efficacy or optimism in schools, whereas that's a really fundamental skill of life. Mm-hmm. That I didn't realize how important it was. And yeah, that, you know, there's learned optimism and as a concept. So I mean, like, the workplace itself is this kind of complex, dynamic environment that's constantly changing, because the workplace of yesterday is different to today because the people coming into it have been affected by their lives outside, and they're bringing, you know, they're all a little bit older too, I suppose. So how does an organization who wants to do this really well actually keep on top of that constant moving, changing dynamic that's in place in front of them? How do they do that?
Yeah, it starts with genuine interest in people, I think. And if you have that, then you line up an HR department that is well equipped with people who know what it is to talk about job design, who know what it is to train people, or who know where you can find people who can do the training or interventions and so forth. And then if you take human resources as serious as you do the output of your organization, of your factory or whatever, then you know that you need to monitor. So if you go to an organization, they know on a daily basis what their financial turnover is, what the revenues are from day to day, from week to week, from month to month, and they discuss it every week, sometimes every day. But you can do that also when it comes to your human resources.
Yeah,
I'm not saying that you need to discuss every day the number of people who is highly engaged, but you can do that, let's say, once every 3 months or once half a year at least. And also you can look every day or every week at absence. You can look at productivity. You can look at all kinds of things. But often people, managers who have been trained to look at efficiency and at money and financial output, they look at performance, and they may monitor behavior even from work episode to work episode, like in call centers or in factories, assembly lines. But they forget to monitor people's well-being or people's ideas, or ask for how can we do things better. And that's so, I mean, that's naive, because people are the experts about how things are going on the work floor. So if you get them into this conversation, then you can maybe optimize work, make it a better place for everyone, make it more productive and nicer for all involved.
And if the ambition of these leaders is to create sustainable high-performance organizations, there's a part of this which is about predicting the future, isn't there? Because, I mean, I was reading one of the, well, I didn't read the study, but I on your website, you alluded to it, the Spanish teachers, where they were tracking them from the start, and they were able to predict, you know, which ones would get into trouble later on in sort of a year. So I mean, like, if you extrapolate that across a workforce, you're able to actually tell a lot. So how much of this is risk prevention?
How much of this is risk prevention? If you would monitor people?
Yeah, if you kind of get a sense of where people are at on a constant basis, and you see changes, and you sort of say, well, if that keeps going in 6 months' time, it's probably going to show up as X, Y, or Z.
Yeah, well, it's risk prevention, but also you got me on the wrong foot with your question, because it's both risk prevention and it's amplification, what you can think about. So if you monitor where people stand, then you know whether their engagement is relatively high or not, whether they are getting more fatigued or not, and whether they need a rest or not, whether in some departments or in some teams they would need more job resources or perhaps another leader, more variety in their tasks. You can know that. And so if engagement is high, but if the productivity is not too high, then you may also come into action and think about how can I sustain the level of engagement and make sure that it will be okay also in the next 3 months or next year. And then you can also, when it's going well, you can keep it going well by investing in people, by making sure that the engaged people can optimally be challenged and support. But also, of course, in terms of risk prevention, of course, you could track the level of the job demands, the levels of the fatigue, but also self-undermining behaviors. That is an early warning sign for me. If there is self-undermining behavior and people admit it, that they create conflicts, create confusion and so forth, then of course you should immediately intervene and try to get rid of the hindrances or the problems that are there, because they stand in the way of the whole process of producing something in a good way.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you put forward those two. I mean, like, when you say job crafting today, it sounds to many people like as if it's a new concept, but as you were saying, you were talking about it in 2010. Yeah. But now you're talking the last 5 or 6 years about playful work design.
Yeah.
So could you just compare and contrast those two things?
Well, job crafting is changing the work tasks, or changing the work environment or the social environment, or creating new resources, mobilizing challenges and so forth. Whereas playful work design is doing the same tasks. It's actually more at the task level than job crafting. So job crafting can also be the social environment, asking for feedback or support, creating or starting a new project, for example. Playful work design is not starting a new project. You do the same task, but you approach it in another way. And you do that in a playful way by using humor, your fantasy, or by making a kind of challenge of the task that you have to do. So, for example, I often make lists before I start today, and then one of the points on my list is, okay, today I want to go from 150 emails to 100 emails. So that's a challenge for me to get, and usually I try to do that in 1 hour, to get rid of 50 emails, which is very difficult. So by approaching the same task in a playful way, you're more likely to do it because it's more entertaining, it's more meaningful, you feel that you achieve something. But also, if you make it more fun, you have a better time while being in a boring meeting, let's say. The playful act could be to make people smile or to come up with a strange word in the middle of the meeting and then see how people react. So yeah, that can make your work episode more interesting and nicer.
I was watching out that you didn't slip a word in that I didn't understand. You're doing it yourself.
I could do that.
So listen, you know, COVID obviously has been with us now for two and a half years or the like. It's interesting just watching some of the interviews you were doing earlier on in the process and how you were viewing it and how it would play out, which I think is bang on in terms of the hybrid, you know, blended work and the like. When you're looking at that whole thing, thing is a dreadful way to describe it, but the pandemic, do you actually believe that it's been a force for good in terms of moving the workplaces to where they needed to get to anyway? And was this going to happen anyway? Did it just accelerate forces that were going to happen, or did it actually really, you know, make things happen that wouldn't have happened normally?
It's a bit complicated, but because we see the chaos at the airports, so what happened is, as you know, that the airports, they were getting rid of people because there were no passengers, and now everybody wants to fly again. But what I've seen is that basically we have been in the Netherlands for about 2 years, 2.5 years in partial lockdown, so in between there were some waves. And now it's almost back to normal. I mean, almost nobody is wearing masks, or we have big events where people meet and gather. And when there are infections, there is not a big problem. The hospitals are not full and so forth. I know that in some places it's still a bit different in terms of measures, like in China, or it has just opened up, I think, in Australia and in New Zealand. And in South Africa, but I think that we have learned to have interviews online. I hardly knew how these things worked. I had worked with it a bit, but only with one program. Now I can work with six programs. It's very, when people say, "Shall we meet?" Your first idea is, "Yeah, we meet online." You say explicitly if you want to meet in person. So. You can work anywhere. As you see, I'm working at home now, which is beautiful because I can make better coffee. I can make a run in the morning, which I did. And when I need to meet other people, I do that. So it's more like in terms of deciding when and where to work, you can be more efficient and you can do it in a better way. So things have changed in that sense. So people are more aware that there are different ways of collaboration. On the other hand, I think things go back very fast to how it was before. I've been traveling a lot already again because people want to see me, want to hear me in conferences. I've been to 9 countries before the summer, I think. So that's crazy. And I was also looking forward to do some traveling, but it was actually very busy, even busier than before. And at most conferences, I was one of the first speakers at a first event. And normally there's 20% no-show, and this time there was always more people than had registered. So,
wow, yeah. But it's interesting, you know, certain leaders obviously now want people back in the office. Do you think that's really a control issue, or do you actually think they really think there's a correlation between creativity with the loss in collaboration that might be experienced by people being online?
I think it's both. So control is a big thing. It depends perhaps also a bit on the type of work. There's a lot of work that has been always on location, and also the truck drivers or people working in factories, they couldn't work at home. But when it comes to office workers, I think that what you see in many countries is that people are going back to work part-time and working part-time at home. And I think the lessons are, and there are now the first papers coming out showing this, most likely, I'm not totally up to the latest literature in that respect, but I think when it comes to being creative and having good brainstorm sessions, that's better life when you meet people, because you can better sense the what's going on in a room. You can influence each other with your enthusiasm and support better than through a screen. Whereas other things like doing concentration work or working on a book, or that's probably better to do that at home or in Croatia for that sake.
But you guys did in your university in Erasmus, you published a report and it was called Still Hanging In There, The Isolation. I'm wondering, you know, up to date now, is that still the case? Are people still feeling isolation, or have they overcome that?
sorry, the university is going back to complete all the lectures on campus again, no streaming and so forth. So things will change. But when people, when my colleagues and me, when we do not lecture, you can decide for yourself where you will be. And I think things are going back to normal. I saw online that the rector of my university about 10 days ago opened the academic year for the international students. That was a meeting in Rotterdam for 5,000 students in a big hall. So yeah, I think it's going completely back to what it was. Although I think that we will more often on the days that people do not have teaching, and on specific days that are popular in the Netherlands to not travel, that's Wednesdays and Fridays, people will often stay at home to do their work, and they will not have lost time because of traveling, commuting. They can do the concentration work, and maybe it's the best of both worlds. If you do like 40-60 or 60-40 and divide the work between the workplace and your home, that could be fine. There are also, of course, a lot of people who do not have a good place at home to work, or who have very young children. So that could be for them, they could be really happy to go back to the workplace. And but I think in the meantime, in many countries, that's possible again. So
and again, the individual personality comes into play here, because yeah. You know, the capability of somebody to be really disciplined, or you know, as you said earlier on, the extrovert who needs the energy of other people around them, you know, yeah. It's trying to create this so that you give everybody what they need. Yeah. Looking at kind of, you know, macro, if you were to sort of say the three biggest problems you think there are in workplaces that you'd love to have a magic wand just to kind of change overnight, what would they be?
The three biggest issues. I thought that you were going somewhere else with your question. So I think one of the, let me say what I thought first when you started.
Yeah. Yeah.
So one of the things that is going to happen is the impact of robots and the impact of new technology, let's say. And you can see that in many industries, in medical technology, in car industry, even in hospitals. So what people will need to do is collaborate with robots. And so that is going to be one of the new challenges we will have in the future. And I think we need to devote a lot of attention to it. How can we do it? How can we make sure that work is going to be meaningful in the future for everyone? You could say that robots and computers and artificial intelligence can take over the dirty work. But if we do that and make everything more efficient, then humans do not have slack time to think about, let's say, more creative and problem-solving things. So that will put everything even under more strain. The robot will take over the easy tasks normally, but we need easy tasks to prepare for the complex tasks, I think. So this is a big thing in terms of big issues in job design and well-being in the workplace. I think, one big intervention would be to make HR as important as strategic management. So to put them on the table with the CEO, with the CFO, so to have a CHO or CHRO, I don't know how you call these people, yep. They should be at the table making strategic decisions with the other managers who take care of where things are going with the company. And that is for me. Sorry?
Elevate that role.
Yeah, elevate that role. That would be, for me, very important. A second one would be, and maybe that is also standing in the way of human resources being at this important place, is that we need to really educate and optimize human resource managers. I think that oftentimes these are people who want to work with people. They do not always know how to read an Excel file or to work with numbers, and we need to educate. They need to be able to convince the financial officer and to make sure that they get that their work is made as important as the other work.
No, I was just going to say that idea of working with robots, I suppose we're doing it every day with Siri and...
it's happening already.
It's happening already, yeah. It's the whole... So, I mean, like, look, you've been very generous giving, me your time today. I suppose just as an end, as we come to the time, because I want to be respectful of that, are you hopeful for the workplace of the future? And how do you know, or how will you assess whether or not your work has been successful and in terms of impact?
Well, I have looked at, because of the new PowerPoints and presentations I'm making, I've looked at on Google for the number of times that job demands resources theory is used. So if you look very specifically, it's about 250,000 times at the moment that you see this word. Whereas when you look for burnout, it's like 14 million times, I think. So I think there is a lot of there's a big stretch that can be much more often used, but our work is very often cited and used in a lot in practice as well. So I'm very happy about that. But of course, it can improve, and I'm hopeful that people will use more of this knowledge in the future. And one of the reasons to think that is that we are a young discipline. We exist only, let's say, 100 years. So many other disciplines exist longer. And if you exist longer, you can build up a better knowledge base and educate more people over time. So I think we will grow further and get more respect. There should be also a Nobel Prize for psychologists, which is not there, but we will get there. We see other kinds of prizes that are given to all kinds of people. So we need to earn the respect. I'm also hopeful because it's like evolution. So people are not stupid. People are smart and will evolve to arranging things in a better way. So in the past, so let me, just a strange example that comes to my mind. In the past, people were using coals to heat their houses. Mm-hmm. Now we have much smarter systems with water and where there is no toxic things coming in the air and so forth. So evolution will tell us that we will eventually use the knowledge that you better not try to get everything out of people and put a lot of demands on them so that tomorrow we have produced so much, because that's only short run. So people will know, also the managers and also the billionaires will know eventually, and maybe even in the next 10, 20 years, that if you really invest in people, they will come with more creative solutions. So your business will be more sustainable. And in the end, it's the differences will always be made by people. So if you really take care of them, then you will do a better job, you will make more money, and you will have more social impact with what you are doing.
Yeah, sustainability is the order of the day, because we won't world if we don't get that right.
Exactly.
Listen, we will do our very best to bring your message again to the world so that you'll be getting the millions and millions of
it. Well, it's nice to have impact with the things you work on. I mean,
absolutely.
It's the same work if nobody would read it versus if a lot of people read it. So I prefer that a lot of people read it.
Absolutely.
Well, maybe you can start reimagining your work and adding some playful elements to stop the boredom creeping in. My thanks to Arnold Bakker for a great interview there and joining us on today's Work Healthy podcast. Next up, we'll be joined by Aviva Insurance's Debbie Bullock to hear how they keep their 22,000 staff healthy and why she insists on leaving loudly every day.